This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As this program is broadcast, the Carolinas are being inundated by a violent storm. In the days leading up to Florence's landfall, the reporting was diligent and ominous, focusing on the storm's trajectory, power, and deadly potential.
North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia, all under a state of emergency.
In hurricanes, more than 75% of the people die from the storm surge and the water.
Surge could act, Michael, like a plug as all of the waterways try to drain into the ocean.
The urgent, if secondary, ramifications of the killer storm are also covered, ranging from the risks of collateral catastrophe.
Crews shut down the Duke Energy Brunswick nuclear plant in Southport, North Carolina, yesterday. It sits roughly 4 miles inland and was expected to be blasted.
To ugly realities pertaining to electoral politics and the Trump administration.
Donald Trump's Department of Homeland Security requested to transfer about $10 million out of the budget for FEMA this year and into the coffers of ICE.
Storm coverage, like much of history, exists in three dimensions of time: the gathering past, the urgent present, the chaotic aftermath. No wonder, then, that storms are the go-to journalistic metaphor for all sorts of havoc, natural and man-made. For instance, we are 10 years from the collapse of the Wall Street titan Lehman Brothers, 10 years since the levees shielding global financial markets from their own recklessness were breached, triggering economic and political tempests even now. And we are just days away from the first anniversary of Hurricane Maria, the storm that ravaged Puerto Rico and laid bare corruption, political hypocrisy, and colonial subjugation. This is an hour devoted to all three dimensions of disaster, and we'll begin in Puerto Rico. In a press briefing Tuesday about the anticipated damage from Hurricane Florence, President Donald Trump said that the federal response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico last September was, quote, an unsung success. This is Anderson Cooper.
I'm not even sure where to begin with this. We should point out the government of Puerto Rico paid a lot of money for GW University to spend months studying the death tolls. They came up with this 3,000 number. Also, a Harvard University study in conjunction with other universities in Puerto Rico did a study that also showed similar numbers. CNN's own reporting interviewing funeral directors also showed thousands of deaths.
Trump doubled down, tweeting on Thursday that the high death toll is a lie and a smear created by Democrats to discredit him. What to do but hold your head in despair? Well, on Twitter, we saw that the political anthropologist Yaramir Bonilla was finding possibility in the president's inhumanity, and we were intrigued. After all, as she's written for the Washington Post, the tempest swirling out of Trump's tweet brings attention back to the island and the opportunity to reiterate the truth. She's now in San Juan working on a book about Puerto Rico before and after the storm called American Disaster. In her Twitter post, she quoted Toni Morrison, who observed that the function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being.
A lot of us suddenly had to put down what we were doing and respond to Trump. And so part of what I was saying was, let's not get distracted in asserting the simple facts of the matter. And in fact, maybe there's a way in which we can use this spotlight that's cast on Puerto Rico every time Trump tweets about us to talk about the real problems we face, which are not just Trump's tweets. what people are talking about here is where we are now in this recovery. I mean, a year out, there's still street lights that are hanging, people living under blue tarps. There was real concern about how folks who still don't have a roof, basic shelter, would face this new storm. And then there's also the longstanding problems of the debt crisis, of austerity, of the dismantling of the education system, the dismantling of the university, the shrinking of the government, the migration crisis. There are so many problems that really surpass Trump and Trump's failures, which he seems intent on reminding us of. But there are a whole host of problems that need to be dealt with in Puerto Rico and that are being dealt with by Puerto Ricans, because we know that we can't really count on Trump or even the federal government.
Just when you think there's no more of the original disaster response failures to disclose, there comes news of something discovered just this week.
What could be millions of bottles of water that were sent to the island to help the survivors of Hurricane Maria has been sitting on a runway in Ceiba, Puerto Rico since last year. FEMA says they gave the bottles of water to the government of Puerto Rico. The question is, what happened then?
There were people here who died from leptospirosis, from having drank contaminated water. And so to think that there was all this water going to waste in this abandoned airstrip was just a little bit too much to bear. But it's also just, you know, the most recent episode in a series of things that have become slowly disclosed, which began with the death counts. From the beginning, local journalists in Puerto Rico were pointing to the fact that the government was hiding the number of deaths. And they were really the ones that led the charge against that. And then slowly it has been revealed how a lot of the financial donations that were made to the Office of the First Lady or to other charities or nonprofits, the aid has not materialized. And there were also these FEMA trailers that were found in private farms with aid that was not distributed. And there were also these trailers at the coroner's office that were found to be leaking and these bodies that had not been autopsied. And so every week it feels like new news surfaces, and it's hard to know which one is going to really take hold in the public imagination and the public discourse. But the million water bottles really caused a lot of stir.
I want to get beyond the failings of FEMA and infrastructure and corruption on the island and get to the underlying problem, which is, I guess you would call it just ongoing colonialism. But I simply must ask you about something that Paul Ryan said in response to press questions on Thursday morning about Trump's tweet.
There is no reason to dispute these numbers. And it's a function of this was a devastating storm that hit an isolated island. And that's really no one's fault. That is just what happened.
This is not just something that happens. It's something that is produced structurally by a weakened state in Puerto Rico, by imperial disdain, by a lack of intervention. Because the folks who died here, they didn't die in mudslides. They didn't die because they were blown away by the hurricane winds. It was the way the storm was handled.
This has been well studied by FEMA itself, by the Government Accountability Office. Harvard and George Washington universities looked into it and found a laundry list of issues.
What they have found was that the majority of people died due to lack of access to health care. And this ranged from lack of access to their medication, to inability to plug in respirators, inability to reach hospitals. So that was the major cause. And then you also had bacterial diseases, the spike of suicides. What is happening in a society to make people feel like there is no alternative, there is no option? And so all of this was very much not a product of simple Mother Nature, but of things that could have been dealt with, that could have been avoided.
We began this by talking about how there may be a silver lining in the president's tweets in that it calls attention to the island. But by the time this story gets on the air, Hurricane Florence will have hit the Carolinas, inundating the mainland and also the news. Is it likely that Puerto Rico will once again be sort of swamped in the process and once again out of the thoughts of the American public?
Here in Puerto Rico right now, we've been preparing for the anniversary of Hurricane Maria, which is next week, bracing ourselves for the possibility of being in the wake of a new hurricane. So our attention is very much on hurricane season and on Maria and on trying to move away from this. But we know that in the United States, attention shifts quickly. Even when the studies of the death count were released, there was very little attention in the mainstream media. So we were already prepared to be ignored during Maria's anniversary, especially as hurricane hits the east coast of the United States. The attention that Trump has brought in some ways has been positive because it has led a lot of reporters to come to Puerto Rico to research exactly what the recovery has looked like, to point to the failures of FEMA, the failures of Trump, and also the failures of the local government and corruption that has been revealed. Puerto Rico's recovery should be a news item for at least a decade. It's going to take that long to really get a sense of what the impact of Hurricane Maria long-term will be.
Yara Mar, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yara Mar Bonilla is a political anthropologist and Carnegie Fellow, currently working on a new book about Puerto Rico before and after the storm, titled American Disaster.
Coming up, the collapse that flooded the world with debt and doubt.
This is On the Media.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 10 years ago this week, the Wall Street investment bank Lehman Brothers collapsed, setting in motion a crisis that devastated the world's economy.
The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend.
Such a blow to investors, whether you're a big trader or whether you have a 401k.
The Dow traders are standing there watching in amazement, and I don't blame them.
I have never live looked at the Dow Jones Industrial Board and seen a 600-point loss.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
But why so shocked? Many of the warning signs had been there all along. Dean Starkman, author of The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism, says that the very nature of business journalism offers some clues about what went wrong. Dean, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you again, Bob.
In the aftermath of the crisis, there was so much hand-wringing over how the mainstream press could have missed this thing. But in your conversations, reporters insisted that they hadn't missed it at all, that they'd covered it, but that the world had simply missed it. So you dug in to find out where the truth lies. What did you look at?
9 publications, mainstream business press, Washington Post, New York Times, Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, Financial Times, Bloomberg, and others. From 2000 to mid-2007, the idea being that that's when the seeds for the financial crisis were laid. That's when the mortgage market ran amok. That's when all of the mortgage products were made on Wall Street and the derivatives were sold.
And I guess what you found were isolated stories that did describe a housing bubble or terrible mortgage products or dangerous derivative trading, but not ones which describe a systemic crisis or brewing catastrophe.
That was the big failure. The overwhelming majority of the work was done within the frame of Wall Street itself, whether or not Lehman would become a bond leader, whether or not Citigroup would recover from scandals and increase its profitability. What was happening in the mortgage market was not something that you were going to learn from interviewing Stan O'Neill of Merrill Lynch, Dick Fuld of Lehman Brothers, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. The sources for the story, if you really wanted to know what was happening and as a result what was going to happen, was going to be outside of Wall Street. State bank regulators, state's attorneys generals, community groups like the Center for Responsible Lending, plaintiff's lawyers, whistleblowers, all of those outsiders that were clamoring to be heard during this period were actually spoken to by isolated reporters, most of whom did not work for the mainstream business press, and had this very important story to tell.
There is a tendency to do these profiles of business celebrities with a kind of journalistic rigor of a Hollywood puff piece. And there's also the tendency to do the equivalent of political journalism, you know, horse race. Right. Who is going to win, Goldman or Lehman, that kind of thing. Did you find a lot of that stuff in your survey?
That's exactly the issue. It's really the frame through which you are viewing the story. If you're looking at Lehman Brothers and its relationship to a subprime lender named FAMCO, you're doing one particular kind of story. But if you're looking at Lehman Brothers in its relation to its competitors, whether its profitability would increase or decrease from one quarter to the next, you are going to be looking at the business press from a completely different frame. And essentially, you are speaking on Wall Street's terms and you're speaking to a Wall Street audience.
I want to ask you about the premise of your research. The reporters said, we covered it. And other observers in the aftermath said, no, you didn't.
If you say, well, we covered the housing bubble, I would say you did. And we covered that banks were taking exceptional risks. Yeah, I would say that's probably true too. But no one was covering a mortgage system that had become unhinged, really systemically corrupt.
You sifted through the haystack and you did find a few needles. There was a 2002 piece in Forbes about toxic mortgages and predatory lending.
What was maddening about the research was their best work really was done in the years 2000 to 2003, really before subprime took off. And then the whole thing completely fell off exactly when the subprime was beginning to spike, 2003 through 2006-7.
You attribute this to two competing and sometimes converging journalistic approaches. Can you tell me about the difference between access reporting and accountability reporting?
Right. Access reporting is about trying to get access to powerful people to find out what they are thinking and intending, and there's a lot of value to that. Its sources, almost by definition, are elites. All of these qualities conspire to give you a very particular and fairly narrow picture of the subject you happen to be looking at. Accountability reporting is a different approach. Accountability reporting would have dissident sources like plaintiff's lawyers and whistleblowers and community groups, and in the case of financial crisis, attorneys general and state bank regulators and all the people who had their fingers on the problem. As opposed to appealing to investor interest, it would be looking for the public interest. And it's not a question of good guys and bad guys. Over the course of my career, some of my most fun moments as a business reporter were merger and acquisition scoops. They were the ultimate access story, and they are really hard to get, and they're super satisfying. The trouble is that all too often, the access tendency tends to overwhelm the accountability practice because, you know, let's face it, accountability reporting makes few friends. It's risky, it's stressful, it's expensive, and at the end of the day, when the story is published, somebody's in trouble.
Can you give me some examples of the kind of reporting we saw in the 90s that was conspicuously absent in the aughts?
The Boston Globe's coverage of Fleet Financial Group. The reporter was a Metro reporter. He was getting tips that there were this spike in foreclosures in minority neighborhoods in Boston and working class neighborhoods. And he began to trace this problem to these small and, you know, highly disreputable mortgage lenders that were not necessarily all local, that were operating in these neighborhoods where they would go up and knock on your door and offer you a home repair and a loan. He tied it back to Fleet Financial Group, which was a innovator, if you will, in the subprime mortgage business. The stories attracted the attention, actually, of Mike Hudson. He did a piece in the Washington Monthly. It attracted coverage by 60 Minutes, which did a devastating piece. It led to congressional hearings, and it led to a 1994 anti-predatory lending law. It was a classic example of journalists, regulators, legislators all coming together to perform an important social function.
But one of the premises of this episode is that calamities do not happen in a moment. There is what's brewing long before them, and then there is the aftermath of undetermined length. And a decade after the Wall Street collapse, this story isn't really over.
We're living in a post-financial crisis world. I happen to be living in Hungary right now. Hungary, now as a quasi-authoritarian government. Its socialist government went into default just about 6 weeks after Lehman. It was a direct consequence of the financial crisis. The Orban government came into power in 2010 and has stayed here ever since. I mean, the financial crisis destabilized democracies around the world.
Let's just say that you were the sultan of all financial journalism. Which stories would you be sicking your watchdogs on in order that we don't repeat the failures of a decade ago?
We've got banking institutions that are fewer and larger than they were before the financial crisis, and they're more armored PR-wise than they ever were back in the day. The rise of PR has been so dramatic and the fall in journalism equally so that it's not a fair fight. If you're looking for where is the actual next crisis, I've seen work that says you should look at the energy sector. I would look at assaults on the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Those are sort of classic areas of vulnerability. But the other category of story is this kind of slow motion crisis of grinding student debt, of personal bankruptcy, of medical debt, and the basic story of people who are working full time, who are unable to pay their monthly bills.
One of the problems leading up to the 2008 catastrophe was the systematic dismantling of the regulatory apparatus. Now, one of the advantages of regulators, in addition to regulating, is they give journalists the kind of information and ammunition they need to report on problems, small and large. In the absence of robust regulation and further dismantling by the Trump administration, are journalists entering a gunfight half-armed?
Yeah, I liken investigative reporting without effective regulation as having all the impact of the sound of one hand clapping. It's not just that journalists use material gathered by regulators, but it flows the other way as well, where regulators and prosecutors and bank examiners and legislators gather ideas or begin their probes based on newspaper accounts. Effective journalism and uncompromised regulation go hand in hand, and if you lose one, then the other is weakened. But that's really just another way of saying that journalism and democracy are really inextricably interrelated. Without a democracy, journalism is going to falter, and without journalism, so is democracy.
Dean, thank you so much.
Bob, it was a pleasure.
Dean Starkman is fellow in residence at the Center for Media, Data, and Society at the School of Public Policy of Central European University. His book is called The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis, and The Disappearance of Investigative Journalism.
10 years on, there's been a lot of analysis of the financial crisis, but understanding, not so much. In 2012, the MIT economist Andrew Lowe published a paper called Reading About the Financial Crisis, a 21-book review, in which he discovered that nobody, not academics, not journalists, not former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, could agree on what really caused it. No agreement, but plenty of conflicting narratives and prescriptions. Mark Blythe is a professor of international political economy at Brown University. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
So my first question involves a kind of lightning round of putative causes that are popular among different groups for different reasons. Let's go through them. Are you ready?
Let's go. Let's play the game.
The financial crisis was caused by handing out subprime mortgages to unreliable would-be householders.
People who, frankly, you know, made bad decisions.
Took out mortgages they couldn't afford to pay.
Or used their houses as piggy banks.
Subprime mortgages were the trigger that lit the dynamite of all those complex derivatives that were also part of it. But at the end of the day, what matters was how the explosion traveled through the system and why it blew up elsewhere in places where you didn't have subprime mortgages. And that has to do with the size of the banks and the way that they themselves were structured, with very little capital and a huge amount of liabilities that they paradoxically call assets.
Number two, it was caused by complex instruments, which are what?
Lehman Brothers was a big player in the credit default swap market.
It was exactly. The collateralized debt obligation.
The splitting of the tranches and the creation of CDOs and CDO squared.
So this narrative is popular with other academics who like to show that they're very clever by understanding what all these esoteric instruments are. And it is an important part of the story. And don't get me wrong, something called asset-backed commercial paper is really important. And it's the plumbing for what happened. This is where everything flowed through. But, you know, you can kind of tell the story without really getting involved in the plumbing.
That it was about excessive leverage.
What brought Bear Stearns down was, I think, basically, we were highly leveraged, and we thought the securities we owned...
Leverage is dead simple. When you've got an income of $100,000, you get a $300,000 mortgage, you're leveraged 3-1. You wonder how bad it was in the financial crisis? There were 4 banks in Iceland that lent enough to the rest of the world to be 1,000% of the gross domestic product of Iceland.
Wow.
Yeah. So excessive leverage as a narrative was popular with bank regulators because, of course, what they want to do is have the banks have less leverage. And that would have been good, except that means the banks earn less money.
Some say it was about inequality and credit.
Since the top 1% now commands more than 1/3 of the wealth, how's the bottom 99% supposed to keep up with the Joneses, if not the Kardashians? By borrowing.
And there's certainly something to this. When you have wage stagnation for the majority of Americans for almost, if not in some cases, more than a generation, how do you fill in the gap? People load up on credit on the expectation they'll pay it off with higher wages. But they don't have the higher wages. They just have a ton of debt. So when they become unemployed, they become insolvent like the banks and they drag each other down.
Who would favor this narrative?
Well, I would say everybody from Bernie Sanders on to the center. The concern with inequality has become one of the touchstone issues of our generation, given the fact that it has risen to historically unprecedented levels. And the financial crisis exacerbated that rather than actually reset it.
How about the crisis was caused by Alan Greenspan, who was head of the Federal Reserve from 87 to 2006, holding down interest rates for too long?
It was our job to unfreeze the American banking system if we wanted the economy to function. This required that we keep rates modestly low.
But some of the Fed governors who worked with you at the time, they think interest rates were too low for too long.
I think they are mistaken.
Essentially, he gave asset protection to everyone in the world. The economy hits a bump, that means you're going to earn less money. Don't worry, I'll make your borrowings cheaper so you don't actually lose any money.
With whom is this narrative about Greenspan popular?
The Greenspan narrative is popular with people who write books about Greenspan, obviously. It's also popular with kind of the journalistic community because the thing about journalism is you want to attach it to personalities. So if you can point at someone who looks like Yoda and sounds like Yoda and said they screwed up, that's kind of popular.
Last in our lightning round, the crisis was caused by bankers' greed.
You can't explain a variable with a constant. It's not as if sort of, you know, just imagine this. In 2005, they were all Mother Teresa and suddenly they all got greedy and it caused the crisis. It just doesn't sound too convincing, does it?
So I guess it's possible that taken all together, maybe they create the right narrative.
Exactly. We're always looking for the cause. But when you have the generator of the whole thing as the entire global economy, why would you think one cause is what matters?
A particular narrative about a cause that irks you more than any other is the one that says we spent too much money and now we have to pay.
Federal debt was going down from 2000 to 2006, and it's the same in Europe. There was no orgy of spending. So what happens is these giant behemothic banks that are massively overlevered are about to blow up the whole world. So you have to save them. That was the too big to fail thing. And then to do that, you give money to what's called recapitalize. You cushion the loans. You run big budget deficits. Close your eyes for 6 months and hold your breath. Suddenly there's a lot more debt. There was no additional spending on schools, hospitals, doctors, anything fluffy and pink that you like. It all went to saving the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want that to stick as the narrative, so they were quite happy to have this enormous bait and switch where particularly politicians on the right used this as an excuse to kill programs that they never liked in the first place.
And one thing you find galling, I know, is the tagline, too big to fail. That if the government didn't do something for the banks, terrible things would happen, and they would happen to ordinary Americans.
It's a very convenient story, and it may also be a true story. This is the most frustrating thing about it. We built this system whereby if any of the big banks that so levered went down, they would take down the whole system. Now, we managed to save that, and it only cost us $17 trillion in central bank bailouts and liquidity and all this sort of stuff. It only cost us a huge amount of lost output, unemployment, lives that have been transformed, not for the better. Now, if it had been too big to fail and the whole system had gone down, it might have been worse. Absolutely. But at the same time, what we're saying is, let's make sure that if you're a giant institution, you can take unbelievable risks. And so long as you're too big to fail, the taxpayer will come and bail you out. This is what annoyed the Tea Party, and I think they were absolutely right in this.
There is a moment in February of 2009, just a month into the Obama administration, Rick Santelli of CNBC is on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He's live on the show Squawk Box. Traders are standing all around him, and he says this.
This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
President Obama, are you listening? Thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July, I'm going to start organizing.
Right? The Tea Party was a kind of canary in the coal mine for the populism of the moment. If we think about Trump now, if we think about Europe, even in Sweden.
What's Europe got to do with any of this? I mean, one of the sustaining narratives is this was fundamentally an American problem, a problem with American banks.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we thought at first. The German finance minister said, this is a problem of Anglo-Saxon capitalism. And then about 6 months later, he found out that German banks and French banks and Belgian banks and British banks had bought 70% of the crappy mortgages. I believe the phrase is caveat emptor. Buyer beware.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it was on European bank balance sheets. And it turns out European banks are twice as levered as the Americans at this point.
What?
So they were, yeah, seriously. Deutsche Bank, in 2012, for every euro they had in reserves, they had 60 out there in the world. Now, if that world is going south, you're going to lose a lot more than 1 euro. So they were very on the hook for the American crisis.
There's a piece in the New York Times this week. It's part of their Lehman Brothers collapse anniversary coverage. Hooray! The policymakers saved the financial system, and America never forgave them. I'd gather you would expand that to Europe as well, as evidenced by the turn towards the right?
Absolutely. And a very simple way to think about this is the following. British wages have been as stagnant for most groups as American wages prior to the crisis. So companies have been making profits, GDP, the measure of the economy, has been going up. Then there's a giant crisis. Millions are made unemployed. People's incomes fall in real terms. The value of their assets falls in real terms. It's taken them in Britain and in most of Europe a whole decade to get back to where they started in terms of their incomes. So you're saying that we saved the system. Yeah, but it cost me a decade worth of income and a hell of a lot of stress. Well, of course, there's going to be a political reaction to that.
Why did it move towards the right instead of towards the left?
But it didn't. If you look at Southern Europe, all the countries that are debtor countries, the Spanish, the Italians, the Greeks, the Portuguese, they've all got left-wing governments, or at least putatively left.
Well, the Italians?
It's a coalition because they have Five Star in the south and they've got the right in the north. But Portugal and Greece and Spain all have left-leaning coalition governments. When you go to the north, it's all the right ones, and the right ones are the creditor countries who've been fed a diet of, we are the hard-working people, and they're the ones who spent all the money. Mm. And then you have a migrants crisis that comes in and exposes to many of the people in those countries that there's no money for them for hospitals or schools or training or whatever. They've had a whole decade of austerity. And guess what? A bunch of foreign people kip up, and there's language training, schools for them, etc., etc. This is the type of dynamite that right-wing populists thrive on.
If you take a step back from 2008, as you've described in your book, it seems to be a 30-year history of workers being squeezed by low wages, which leads to ballooning debt.
The 70s was all about inflation. And it was all about inflation because you had super tight labor markets and big unions, and they were able to push prices up. So we spent 30 years deregulating our markets, making labor markets flexible, beating down on unions, globalizing our markets. And what you end up with is labor has no ability to affect price. And indeed, most companies have no ability to affect price if you take out Amazon and these big giants. So what does that mean? It means that profits then do not get split evenly between capital and labor. They all go to capital. And that's the inequality skew. So we've now got to a point whereby that skew has become so gross that even bailing it out with lots and lots of credit has reached its limit. Think student loans. What are you going to do, another $1 trillion in student loans? So You've reached the limit of credit finance growth, but we didn't change the system. We built the banks back up again and said, please do it again.
Just this week, there was news from the Census Bureau that the household income in the U.S. has finally reached its 2007 pre-recession levels at $61,372. Now, the income growth in the last few years is not from increased pay. It's from increased employment. What does that tell you?
It tells me we still have the Bill Gates problem. Bill Gates walks into a bar. On average, we're all millionaires.
Right. And in 2015, Wall Street bonuses were $32 billion.
And everyone on minimum wage in the whole country added together got precisely half of that.
So, if nothing has changed, and we still have American workers crushed by low wages, are we setting ourselves up for more personal debt, more borrowing from banks, and the same amount of no regulation of their bigness? Are we doomed to repeat this?
I mean, it depends on where you are up the income distribution. Mm-hmm. If you're in the top 20%, you're not being crushed. If you're in the top 10%, you're positively being massaged. If you're above that, then, you know, I can't even think of the metaphor. But when the next generation, the millennials, can't form assets, they're not buying houses, they're not buying cars, because they're too busy paying back debts. Debts other generations didn't have to accrue because things were free. Then you got a problem.
Mark, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Call anytime.
Mark Blythe is a professor at Brown University and the author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea.
Coming up, the arc of our attitude toward business reflected in 90 years of film history.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Per Hansen is a professor of business history at the Copenhagen Business School and the co-author of a new study, Making Sense of Business and Community in Hollywood Films, 1928 to 2016. Films that sound a little like this.
So a new industry moves into an undeveloped area. Factories go up, machines are brought in, a harbor is dug and you're in business. It's purely coincidental, of course, that people who never saw a dime before suddenly have a dollar. And barefooted kids wear shoes and have their teeth fixed and their faces washed.
Greed will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time. Yeah!
From Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times in 1936 to The Big Short in 2015, Hansen sifted through 81 films to map out the trajectory of America's volatile relationship with the boardroom and the big board on Wall Street. Because, as you might have guessed, how we see the world shapes the world and how we behave in it. Thus, the power of film.
Anthropologist Grant McCracken argues that we all have kind of what he calls a cultural blueprint, a kind of a roadmap for understanding and acting in the world. Films provide a kind of blueprint for the viewers to help them in a world that is very often difficult to navigate in.
You've divided the history of business-related films, which spans practically the history of film, into several categories. You did notice a trend from cautious idealism to disillusionment to cynicism to whatever it is we have now.
Yeah, that is true. Early movies from 1928 to 1949 focus on the role of the community on Main Street, while finance and big corporations are the villains. This is related to the Great Depression and all the misery that was going on at that time and the role of finance in the Great Depression.
The classic case you cite is It's a Wonderful Life from 1946, right. The essential yeah. Christmas film, expresses goodwill toward men through an ailing savings and loan, which has been targeted by an avaricious Lionel Barrymore, who's resistant to Jimmy Stewart's passionate pleas.
What'd you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle.
If you are an evil capitalist, you could say, like Mr. Potter, you're alone and nobody likes you. Peter Bailey, who established the savings and loan, even though he didn't focus on money and weren't a rich man, he was a rich man in a different way because he was part of this local community. And that's the basic message of this whole film and a number of other films from the same period. These films are taking place in the Great Depression in the 1930s, that being part of something bigger than yourself is much more important.
Now, some of these films express that view a little more didactically than others. You mentioned the 1954 film Executive Suite. We have a clip where the board of Treadway, a furniture company, is about to elect a new president. Don Walling, the head of production, is up against L.P. Shaw, the finance and accounts manager. At the decisive board meeting, Shaw argues that a company is answerable first and last to its stockholders. Walling disagrees, and you say this is a teachable moment.
Now, let's assume, Shaw, that you're the man running the Treadway Corporation your way. Would you be satisfied to measure your life's work by how much you raised the dividend? So $4 or $5 or $6 or $7? Would that be enough? Is that what you want engraved on your tombstone when you die, the dividend record of the Treadway Corporation?
Are you suggesting that earnings aren't important?
I'm suggesting no such thing, and you know it. Shaw's right when he says that we have an obligation to our stockholders. But it's a bigger obligation than raising the dividend. We have an obligation to keep this company alive. Not just this year or next or the year after that. Sometimes you have to use your profits for the growth of the company. Not pay them all out in dividends to impress the stockholders with your management record.
But then something happens in the 60s, and the hopeful tone changes.
One of the very early films that reflect this is The Apartment with Jack Lemmon. We see Jack Lemmon in a big company where meritocracy is nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason he's getting promoted in the company is because he lends his apartment to his bosses, who brings the office girls and commit adultery in the apartment. It signifies the beginning of a period of this disillusionment that grows over time in the 1960s and in particular in the 1970s.
Say, Baxter, you gave me the wrong key.
No, I didn't.
But this is the key to the executive washroom.
That's right, Mr. Sheldrake. I won't be needing it because I'm all washed up around here.
What's gotten into you, Baxter?
Just following doctor's orders. I've decided to become a mensch. Do you know what that means? A human being.
Something else that's marked in The Apartment, and also you say more musically in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, is that women in the workforce, they're treated like staplers.
A secretary is not a toy. No, my boy, not a toy. To fondle and dandle and playfully handle in search of some puerile joy. No, a secretary is not, definitely not, a toy.
Point is that this is no longer a rational organization with executives that try to promote the good of society and so on. They're only looking out for their own interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick with Jack Lemmon then. You got Harry Stoner in 1973's Save the Tiger, who wants to save his small garment factory, but has a big fight with his longtime partner, Jack Gilford, because he decides he needs to torch it.
What the hell else am I going to do? Just tell me.
We invented a new kind of arithmetic last year.
But we survived. We kept our people working. 71 girls, 14 salesmen, secretaries, all making a living.
Phil, the government has another word for survival, and it's called fraud.
Save the Tiger is an important film. The 50s and 60s movies were, to a high degree, focused on the internal workings of the big organization. But in the 70s, the perspective moves outside the offices, and you're also watching Stoner's private life. The television is running, and it reports on all the misery going on in the world, war and materialism and consumerism, and you get the feeling that the society is falling apart. You have to look out for yourself because no one else does. He's a decent man, but he just can't figure out how to survive, and that leads him to try to have his factory burned down in order to get the insurance money.
As you head into the 80s, that brings us to Wall Street. Gordon Gekko.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
Who wore suspenders and carries around an early cell phone the size of a shoebox.
Yeah.
Money never sleeps, pal.
He also influences people in the real world. One of them, now a law and finance professor, decided he wanted to be part of Gekko's world. Another guy, a young law school graduate, decided he wanted to work at the SEC to regulate him.
Even though a lot of young people came to idolize Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko, the important message is that Gordon Gekko was sent to jail.
Let us lead up to the meltdown with a film from the 90s, Other People's Money. Danny DeVito as Larry the Liquidator.
Whoever has the most when he dies wins. Look, it's the American way.
He's like something out of a comic book.
Big business, as you knew it from the 1950s, is about to fall apart. There are new theoretical developments in economic theory that argues that conglomerates are no longer efficient. And that's where Larry the Liquidator comes in. He buys up companies and then he splits them up in separate parts and sells them off. So he doesn't really care about production.
Right. If big manufacturing is falling apart, other people's money looks ahead to what the future of business is, which is basically creating financial instruments. Money about money, not about stuff.
There's one common trait in all the movies, which is that the focus is on the bankers and that they are causing what is going on here.
And why don't we begin with Margin Call, which is a 2010 film based on the Lehman Brothers collapse. John Told, the CEO of a large investment bank, orders a manager to unload collateral debt obligations, CDOs, for billions of dollars to save the bank.
And it's certainly no different today than it's ever been.
1637, 1797, 1819, 37, 57, 84, 1901, 07, 29, 1937, 1974, 1987. Jesus, didn't that me up good? 92, 97, 2000, and whatever we want to call this. It's all just the same thing over and over. We can't help ourselves. And you and I can't control it or stop it or even slow it. We even ever so slightly alter it. We just react. And we make a lot of money if we get it right.
This is the big speech of the film. The difference between this film and Wall Street is that this time around, no one goes to jail. Nothing happens. It just goes on and on and on, and there's nothing you can do about it. So the cynicism and the disillusionment is complete.
What do you think about The Big Short? This is probably the most entertaining explanation of what caused the collapse and who seemed to know about it and who believed they would benefit from it and who would suffer. Steve Carell plays a character who gets an inkling of what's going on. He's sitting on a balcony overlooking Central Park, deciding whether he should cash out or walk away.
I have a feeling that in a few years, people are going to be doing what they always do when the economy tanks. They will be blaming immigrants and poor people.
Mark, can we sell now? I mean, the fund will make almost $1 billion.
You know, once we sell, we'll be just like the rest of them. You know that.
No, we're not. We're not the bad guys here. We didn't defraud the American people and prey on their dreams of owning a home.
Since he's cashing in on all these derivatives, he does not follow his conscience, recognizing the fact that ordinary people, that Main Street is suffering from what is going on here. So the message is exactly the same as in Margin Call, but it's even more cynical.
Do you see another trend arising, or we're still 10 years later in the post-collapse film era?
Maybe we are not even post yet. In 2007, it was a financial world that was under threat, and that ended in 2009. Then came the economic recession, and now we're dealing with the political consequences. You can go all the way back to the Great Depression and look at the same sequence. It begins with finance, then comes the economic depression or the recession, and then comes the political ramifications. If you think about nationalism in Europe and the US, this is part of the financial crisis that is still unfolding.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pierre Hansen is a professor of business history at the Copenhagen Business School and co-author of the study Making Sense of Business and Community in Hollywood Films, 1928 to 2016.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Feder, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chartavetti, Jackie Sophia, and Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer, Merritt Jacob, and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.